If you're a parent, you're going to understand this. And the stories that we're going to look at this morning in the text in Genesis 21 and 22 are going to be difficult for you to handle. But if you are a parent, there are times when you have to lead your kids into situations or circumstances that you know are going to be difficult or painful for them. But you do it because you know that the end result is going to be better, right? So there were times when Trevor was very young, I think between 1 and 2 years old, he had to have a heart cath. And so I'm in the room when we check in with all of the nurses. There were 4, 5, 6 of them around the table. And we are literally physically holding this little thing down on the bed as they work the IVs in and start connecting him to all the stuff that they had to do as he screamed and cried and flailed. And we knew that the end result was going to be better. Like, he needed to have this done, but he didn't understand that. And so it was very difficult for him and very difficult for us. I remember the first time our son Trent had his blood drawn, which this is really going to be weird, but the first time he had his blood drawn, he was a teenager. Because we knew it was going to be bad when that happened. And really, surprisingly, the first time they drew his blood, he didn't flinch. When they, like, he just watched them. They stuck the needle in his arm. He did not make a move. It's crazy. The second time they took his blood, it's not the same story. He knew what was coming. But he learned. Like, as a parent, you know that sometimes you have to lead your children into difficult things, and we're able to handle that because we know that the end result is going to be better for them. Like, we know where this is going, we know where this was leading, and so even though it causes pain and discomfort right now, we know the end result is going to be better. And we have to make those calls. As moms and dads and grandparents, we have to make those calls because they can't make them for themselves. Children are children for a reason. They can't reason some of those things out, and so we have to make that decision for them. Today, we're going to look at two parallel stories involving a parent and a child, a mom and her son, and a dad and his son. And neither of these stories are pleasant. It's one of those places in the Bible where you read the story and you kind of come out on the other side going, what in the world is going on? Like, not only does it make you question what God is doing, because we read these stories and we're like, I can't imagine, like, God, what in the world are you trying to accomplish here? But I think even more than that, sometimes it makes us question God. And we're like, if this is the kind of thing that God allows or God does, then I'm going to have to kind of rethink my theology a little bit. But I would just say, once again, as we read the Bible, remember it takes place in a different time, different situation, different culture, different things going on. And so, yes, these stories are rough. They're hard to hear. If you're a parent who loves their child, it's hard to hear these stories. But we're learning new things about God right along with Abraham. And as we've said many times before in this series, there's more to the story than meets the eye. So let me get you up to speed before we jump into the first story. We've been looking at the life of Abraham kind of step by step from the time in Genesis 12 when God first calls Abraham. He's in Ur of the Chaldeans and he's just hanging out with his family. He thinks he has his life all planned out. And God says, hey, Abraham, I want you to give all of that up, your father, your family, your future. I want you to give that up, and I want you to go to the land that I'm going to show you, that I'm going to lead you to, a place you've never been before, and I'm going to make you a great nation. And so there's a lot of years, about 25 years between God calling Abraham, 25, 30 years between God calling Abraham and when God, like, fulfills or begins to fill the promise and Abraham actually has a son. In the meantime, as we've looked over the last several weeks, Abraham makes some mistakes and he and Sarah do some weird things. And so last week, We looked at how they finally find out that Abraham is going to have a son, and then Sarah hatches this plan, remember? And she's like, hey, Abraham, you're going to have a son, and I'm barren, and so here's my maidservant Hagar. Why don't you sleep with her and bring about a child? And maybe that's how God is going to fulfill his promise. And Abraham goes ahead and does it. And so Hagar has Ishmael. And what we're going to look at today, Sarah has now given birth to Isaac, so the son of the promise. But Hagar and Ishmael's now mid-teens, somewhere around that, somewhere between probably 12 and 18 or something. And Hagar and Ishmael are making life difficult for Sarah and for Isaac. And we looked a little bit at that last week, but it's a difficult life. And this struggle, because Sarah is now afraid for Isaac's life, I think that's what's going on as we read this story. And it puts Abraham in a tough position. Abraham loves his son Ishmael. And he loves his wife of 75 years, Sarah. And he loves his newest son, Isaac, the son of the promise. And so he's caught in this struggle. And Sarah, his wife, demands that Hagar and Ishmael have to leave, that they be sent away, that Abraham kind of kicks them out of the house because Sarah is worried. She's trying to protect Isaac, and she's trying to protect this promise that God has given them. And Abraham doesn't know what to do, the text tells us. He's not sure what to do, and so God shows up, and he says, Abraham, look, go ahead and do what Sarah has said. Send Hagar and Ishmael away, and don't worry about it, because I'm going to protect them. I will kind of be her father, her husband, and I will take care of them if you send them away. Okay, so that's what's going on in the story. Abraham has now is sending Hagar and Ishmael away, and so let's read that story in Genesis 21. Abraham rose early in the morning. He took bread and a skin of water, and he gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulders along with the child. I don't think he put the child on her shoulders. He just gave her the child, and sent her away, and she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And when the water and the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes, and then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot, so, bow. And she said this, "Let me not look on the death of my child." And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice, and she wept. Now, typically when we read this story, And then there's a little more to it. Like, she thinks she's going to die. She thinks Ishmael's going to die. God shows up and opens some things up. We'll talk about that in a minute. But typically when we read this story, we have a few knee-jerk reactions to it. First of all, we're like, wait a minute. I thought Abraham and Sarah is the father of faith. I think they were supposed to be good people. I thought God used good people in the Bible. And so how terrible is it for Abraham and Sarah just to abandon Hagar and to kick her and Ishmael out of that? Like, that's his own flesh and blood. How could he do that? And so we get angry with Abraham and Sarah. And then we look at their situation. They go out, they just live out in the desert, and we're like, oh my goodness, it's so sad. That these people, like Hagar and Ishmael, it's not bad enough that they get kicked out of the house, but they have to just wander in the desert. Like, they can't, there's no hope for them. There's no help for them. There's nobody around. They don't have a home. This is terrible. And we're just really, like, we get really caught up in this story. And then kind of at the end, we go, well, at least God is going to make Ishmael into a nation. That's kind of the covenant that God makes with Hagar. He says, Hagar, don't worry. I'm going to make Ishmael into a nation. In fact, he's going to have 12 sons. There's going to be 12 tribes. It's very much like the promise God makes to Abraham. And Jacob has 12 sons. He's going to have a big nation of people. Like, I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to make them fruitful and multiply. But I think we get so upset with Abraham and Sarah that we miss what else is going on in the story. Did you hear the part about how Hagar just sets her son under a bush and walks away. She just leaves him alone to die. What kind of parent leaves their child to die in the wilderness? Like if that's you or me, if that's you or me, we're right there. We're holding our child. We're crying with them. We're maybe not crying. Maybe we're like, hey, everything's going to be okay. I don't know if you do this. Man, excuse me. I don't know if you do this, but when Andrea and I watch movies and there's some tragic event that happens and there's some adult or parent that shows up in the moment and they're telling the other person, everything is going to be okay. I'm like, no, it isn't. They're going to die. You just told them it's going to be okay and it's not going to be okay. Like, And then I try to put myself in that position. I'm like, you know, maybe it's okay to mislead somebody a little bit when you know it's near the end. I don't know. But if you think about it for a moment, Hagar should be right there with Ishmael, holding him and comforting him and talking about the birds that are flying around or the beautiful, like, whatever, distracting him with whatever she can until he dies, because that's her job as a parent, to protect her child for as long as possible. And yet she doesn't. She just leaves him and walks away because she doesn't, like it tells us in the text, she just doesn't want to see him die. So she leaves him alone next to a bush. And the other thing we have to remember is, I know this story, when we think about it, we think about Ishmael as a young child. He was not a young child. Now, unless the author like switches the timeline around a little bit, Ishmael is probably 15, 14, 15, 16, maybe 18 years old at this point. He is not a young kid. In fact, in the desert, Ishmael lives a lot longer than Sarah does. Than Hagar does. Right? Because Hagar is, she's kind of an old lady herself at this point. Not a spring chicken. Ishmael is a teenager. He's going to survive in the desert much longer than Hagar is. And then I got to thinking about that. Why would Hagar assume that Ishmael is going to die and she doesn't want to watch it? And the only reason I can come up with, and it's purely speculation, don't go telling your preacher friends that this is what happened. Purely speculation, just an opinion, observation. I think the only way she can leave Ishmael and go off to let him die alone is if she takes the food and water with her. Now it becomes much more likely that Ishmael's going to die first. The point is that Hagar abandons her son in his time of need. And the only reason that they live is because God shows up to Hagar. And it's really funny in the story. He points out a well. It says he opened her eyes and she sees that there's a well nearby and it sustains their life. And then he makes this covenant with Hagar concerning Ishmael, and he's going to survive and it's going to be good. That's the first story. Let's look at story number two. This one's going to take a little bit more time to get through. After these things, God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. God said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there. By the way, Isaac is not Abraham's only son, is it? No, he has another son, Ishmael, who's now been sent away. I think what they're saying is, you're the only son of the promise. Remember, Ishmael was never supposed to be born. Sarah and Abraham conspire together with Hagar to have Ishmael because they think Sarah's pregnant. Sarah's barren. They got to make a way, right? Remember, they're trying to solve a problem that God doesn't have. And that's how you get Ishmael. And so from the text and the line and in the story and the promise, Isaac is his only son of the promise. And so he says, take this son, the son you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains on which I will show you or tell you. So, verse 3 is very cavalier. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac, and he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. And on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. And then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey and the boy. The boy and I will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and he laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the knife and the fire, and they went, both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father!" Look, there's an exclamation mark. He's like, yells it. Remember, that is going to come back into play later. And Abraham says, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Like, that was the one question Abraham didn't want him to ask. And he asks it. Abraham says, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went, both of them together. And when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then Abraham reached out his hand and he took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." This is a rough story, right? And there's some knee-jerk reactions we have to this story, just like with the Hagar story. And number one has to be, how can God ask Abraham to kill his child? And I think that sticks out, because the next kind of thought we have is, if God asked Abraham to kill his child, when is God going to ask me to kill my child? We can't handle that. And so this story, it bothers us, and it gets in and it messes with things. But I think outside of how could this good, loving, gracious, merciful God ask Abraham to kill his only son? But like, it went on, like, your only son, the son you love, Isaac, the son of the promise. I think the next question is, how in the world does Abraham just go along with it? In what world does this make sense? Because if God comes to you or I and says, "Hey, I want you to do this," we're like, "Nope, not going to happen." Besides all of that, remember that Abraham has been waiting for 100 years, like 25, 30 years since the promise, but he's been waiting to have his own kids for 100 years. There's something that I think we skip over really, really too quickly. In verse 1, we're immediately told, in fact, the very, very beginning, chapter 22, verse 1, we're immediately told God wanted to test Abraham. And I think we have to remember, everything that comes after that is a test. This is a test. And because it's a test, we have to understand that God never intended to have Abraham kill his son or sacrifice his son Isaac. That was never the point. The fact that Abraham doesn't know this makes it a test, right? Because if God shows up and says, "Hey, Abraham, I'd like to test your faith and how much you trust me, and so I'm going to ask you to sacrifice your son Isaac as a burnt offering on this mountain I'm going to show you, but don't worry, I'm going to stop you before it gets to the end." Abraham's like, "Okay. I don't have to do it," whatever. Abraham doesn't know it's a test, and that's what makes it a test. That's how it works. So I think we have to remember, God was never going to let Abraham kill his son, but he did want us to learn something. And so we have to read the rest of that story going, "Okay, God, what is it that we need to understand from this story? We know that you're testing Abraham. We know that you never wanted him to kill his son. But what's the test? What's going on? What do we need to learn?" Now, the reason Abraham isn't shocked, and that's a shocking thing to us, that Abraham's just like, "Okay, whatever, I'll kill my son." The reason Abraham isn't shocked by God's request is because every single religion in Abraham's day required child sacrifice. Every religion that Abraham was aware of in his timeline required child sacrifice. The Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Assyrians, the Chaldeans, remember, Ur of the Chaldees is where Abraham was called from. He's a Chaldean, a Babylonian, and they sacrificed children there. This is part of the normal worship of the gods of the land. And so when God says, hey, I want you to offer your son, Abraham's like, okay, I was waiting for that, because every god of their day asked that to happen. So it comes as a shock to us reading the story, but it was not a shock to them. What is shocking, I think, about these two stories is the difference between how Hagar handles the death or the approaching death of her son Ishmael and how Abraham handles the approaching death of his son Isaac. Now, if you read the stories, you realize that Hagar may have been in more control of Ishmael's death than we first thought. And we know Abraham certainly is in control of Isaac's death. So these two stories, they're just interwoven with each other. There are, in fact, a whole bunch of similarities between these stories. The first similarity is the way it starts out. It says, early in the morning. So Abraham, early in the morning, he gets up, he sends Hagar off, and then he gets Ishmael or Isaac ready. And that Hebrew phrase for early in the morning appears only two times in all of the Old Testament. And both times appear in these stories, chapter 21 and chapter 22. And there is a whole bunch of more similarities between these two stories. If you want to look at those and see the connections and how deep they go, if you go to the website reallife.faith and you click on watch, listen, and you go to episode 5 or part 5 of this series, all of that stuff is in the notes there, so you can follow along this morning or if you want to go back and look at it. But there's just a ton of, like, these two stories are parallel stories. We're meant to read them together. But let's be honest. If God came and asked you to sacrifice one of your children, one of two things would happen. Either you would say, any God who asks me to kill one of my children is not a God I'm willing to follow. Or if by some weird, like, just go along with me here, if by some weird way you're like, okay, God, I'll kill my kid, from that moment on, you must emotionally cut off that child because you would not be able to follow through with what you're about to do if you stayed emotionally available and open to them. So one of the two things happen if God asks us to do this. Either we cut off God or we cut off our child. It's too hard. Cutting off your child is what Hagar seems to do. She's like, I can't watch this. I can't be a part of this. I'm just going to let him die alone. But it's not what Abraham does. And the author tells us it's not what Abraham does through a really interesting thing. It's a hidden phrase that's buried in the midst of the story in Genesis 22. And this story of Abraham and Isaac, it's called the Akedah, or the binding of Isaac. And it's a chiasm. If you've been coming to Real Life for a while, you know we've talked about this before. It's an ancient Hebrew poem that has a hidden treasure, something in the text for us to understand. And that's what we're gonna look at next. So the way that you find a chiasm is you look for the bookends in the story. And those come in this story, Genesis 22, in verse 1 and verse 11. So we have these parallel statements here that are made. In verse 1, God calls to Abraham. God's going to test Abraham, and he calls to him, and Abraham says, here I am. And in verse 11, while Abraham is about to follow through with sacrificing Isaac, God speaks to him again, Abraham, Abraham, and Abraham says, here I am. Now, Marty Solomon says this actually is a Hebrew conjugation. So it's several words that are kind of smushed together and they make up this phrase. And it's similar today to someone saying, like, I hear you, or I'm present. You have my attention. If you're the old Avatar movie fan, they say, I see you. And basically what it means is I'm engaged, I'm with you, we're together, I'm focused on you. Like, okay, I'm not looking at other things. I'm with you. And so in the opening and the closing of this chiasm, Abraham is saying to God, the Hebrew word, and I'm going to butcher it here, it's hanuni, here I am. Here I am. God speaks and he says, here I am. I'm with you. I'm listening. What do you want to say? As we move to the center, towards the center of this treasure within the text, the next pair of things that happen come in verse 6 and verse 9. Abraham in verse 6 takes the wood for the sacrifice and he lays it on Isaac. And then in verse 9, Abraham takes Isaac and he lays him on the wood. So these are the next parallel things that happen. The next pair come in verse 6 and verse 8, and we're going to spend a little bit of time here. The phrase is, they went, both of them together. Verse 6 that appears, and verse 8 that appears. They went, both of them together. And this is really, really important for us to understand the story and what's going on. In fact, I think understanding what's going on between the first time this is said and the second time it's said, just those two verses, completely changes the way we understand the story. Typically, when we read this story, we picture in our minds Abraham as this strong, burly, like remember they live in the wilderness. He's this strong, burly, kind of lumberjacky guy, big muscular guy. And he is coming to this point with his son Isaac, who we often picture as this young child who can't really defend or care for himself. And so this big burly dad is going to ruthlessly tie up his child and forcibly lay him on an altar to sacrifice him. Except that's not really what went on at all. Remember, Abraham is somewhere around 115 years old. 115 years old. Now, he lives to be 175, but he is nearing the end. Like his strength is beginning to wane here. Isaac, on the other hand, is not 115 years old. In fact, he's maybe 13, 14, 15, 16 years old at this point. If Isaac is unable to overpower his father, if he isn't able to overpower his father, he absolutely can outrun him. Okay, so you're Isaac, and you're going up to this mountain. You're like, where's the sacrifice? And dad's like, you're the sacrifice. I'm gone. Like, this is Coyote Roadrunner kind of thing. Like he just, zip, he's gone. Like, I'm not sticking around for this. And there's no way Abraham catches him. Like, Isaac just throws off the wood, and he bolts for the door. So there's something has to be going on here. The author wants us to understand something very important is happening there. When we read this phrase, they went both of them together, it means they were in agreement. It means they had together determined what to do, and they went in unison to accomplish it. Whatever it was they were doing, they went both of them together means they determined what needed to be done, and then they headed to do it as one person. In verse 6, Isaac thinks that he is going with his dad to make an offering to their God on a mountain. And he's like, I'm in. I worship the same God. Let's go. And so they go, both of them together, to make this sacrifice. Isaac is on board. But in verse 8, I believe Isaac now knows he's the sacrifice. And I think Isaac now is choosing to go with his father, knowing that he's going up the hill to die. That all happens in verse 7, the verse right in between these two. But the author wants us to know that when they continue in verse 8, both of them together, Isaac knows what's happening. Isaac is willingly going with his father as the sacrifice. But that's not the center of the poem. The center of the poem actually happens in verse 7. Apparently, Abraham has been making what I would only assume is kind of small talk with Isaac. Because remember, Abraham knows what happens on the top of the mountain. Abraham knows he's going to sacrifice his son. And they're down at the bottom of the mountain. They're making their way up. Verse 6 hasn't happened yet. They're at the bottom. They're going together. And then they get to verse 7. Verse 8 hasn't happened yet. They get to verse 7. And it says, Isaac asks his father. He says, "My father," yells it. Why would Isaac have to kind of yell to get Abraham's attention? Unless Abraham is distracting himself with mindless conversation because he wants to talk about everything except what's happening. He's trying to distract Isaac because he doesn't want Isaac to figure it out. The elephant in the room is prominent, and Abraham's doing everything he can to distract him. It's why, as parents, when we're going to take our children to the hospital to have a procedure that we know is going to cause them pain but will make them better in the end, we don't tell them what's going to happen beforehand. Hey, guess what? We don't even tell our animals when they're going to the vet. I don't want to bring it up. It's too painful. It's going to be painful for them. It's going to be painful for me. I don't want to bring it up. And I think Abraham is just talking and talking and talking, and Isaac has to go, "Dad, shut up for a second. I got a question. Listen to me." He says, "My father." And it kind of it's like daddy. In fact, the Hebrew phrase means that he interrupted his father. The way it's used, he interrupted his dad. He's like, "Dad, we have the knife and we have the fire and we have the wood. Where's the lamb?" And Rabbi David Foreman says, it's in this moment where Abraham's response is, "God, my son, God will provide the sacrifice, my son." And Foreman says, understanding that phrase depends on where you put the comma. Because maybe what Abraham said was, "God will provide the sacrifice, my son. You are the sacrifice." And if we look at verse 6, they went both of them together. And then verse 7, Abraham says, God's going to provide the sacrifice. And verse 8 says, they went both of them together. I think Isaac knew what was going to happen on the top of that mountain. And I think he trusted his father enough to continue the journey. Remember, Abraham gets this message from God, and he sucks it up for 3 days until they make it to the top of the mountain. And he is present with Isaac. He is attentive with Isaac. In fact, the center of the chiasm in verse 7 is that phrase, "Hanuni," "Here I am." Isaac says, "My father," and Abraham says, "Here I am. I'm not going anywhere. I'm with you. I'm going to be with you till the end. I'm staying with you. I'm not going to distance myself. I'm not going to abandon you. I'm staying true to God, and I'm staying true to you." Abraham never leaves Isaac, and he never forsakes him. What they're going to is terrible. It's a horrible thing, but he never leaves him. Remember, God was never going to let Abraham kill his son, but he did want us to learn something. Because here's what we know from the story. Roughly 2,000 years after Isaac willingly walks up that hill in the area of Moriah, Jesus would willingly walk up a hill in the very same region. In fact, some people say it's the very same hill. And God would give his son, his only son, who he loves, as our sacrifice. God used Abraham's test to paint a picture of Jesus' triumph. And the phrase we're left with in the story is, Hanuni, here I am. This very same phrase, the unconjugated form of this conjugation that's used in Genesis 22, the very same form is what God tells Moses at the burning bush a few hundred years later. When Moses says, God, I'll go to the Israelites, but who do I tell them is sending me? And God says, Hanuni, here I am. I am that I am. It's the same Hebrew thing. And when Jesus and his disciples are in the garden praying on the night that he is betrayed, and the soldiers and the temple guard and Judas come to him, and Jesus says, who are you seeking? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus' response is, Hanuni, here I am. It's the same phrase echoed throughout history. But this story of Abraham and Isaac, it's not just about seeing Jesus. It's not just about this parallel, this picture of Jesus and God. I think there's something else for us as followers of Jesus to understand in this story. When God asked Abraham to do something difficult, Abraham doesn't choose his family over God, and he doesn't choose God over his family. Abraham takes 3 days to make a journey that should have taken a half a day. When you look at the geography and where they were, that trip from where Abraham and Isaac were in the area of Beersheba to Moriah and that mountain was about a half a day's journey. And some people believe that Abraham and Isaac went all the way around the Dead Sea to get back to Mount Moriah. Like Abraham was giving God all the time he needed to change his mind. And when he didn't, Abraham says, okay, God, you've made a promise to me that this son, my son Isaac, is going to be the one through whom the promise comes, not only to be a great nation, but to bless every family in the world. And I believe that even if you want me to kill my son, you can bring him back to life. Abraham had to believe that. And so when God doesn't stop Abraham, he is determined to trust God, even though he doesn't like the direction. Abraham believes that God can raise Isaac back from the dead, since it was through Isaac that the promise was going to come. And the question then that comes to my mind for you and I today is, how much faith do we have? Can I say to God, here I am, when he asks me to do the impossible? Can I go on with God together, both of them together, when he wants me to go somewhere that I don't really want to go? Can I remain emotionally available when I am emotionally distraught? And I want you to know today before you leave, because if this is your first time, you're like, man, that's a rough story. What's going on here? I want you to know God will never ask you to sacrifice your child. In fact, later in the story in Leviticus and when Moses is on the mountain getting to God, God says, do not ever do that. I will never ask you to sacrifice your child. God will never ask you to do that. But he may ask you to sacrifice your comfort. He may ask you to kill your pride. He may ask you to leave your former way of life or the things that you've been doing. He may ask you to walk back into your non-Christian friends' lives and be emotionally present for them in order to lead them to Jesus. I don't know what God may ask you to part with, or what task God may ask you to perform. But this story of Abraham and Isaac stands as our example. When God calls, our response is, Hanuni, here I am. I don't know where it's going to lead, God, but I trust you enough to follow you. And when others call us, our response to them should be, Hanani, here I am. What we see in Abraham is what Jesus says a couple thousand years later. He says all of the law and the prophets, everything that God ever wanted to accomplish with man, every responsibility that we have to God is summed up in this. Love God and love others. When God calls, we say, here I am. And when others call, we say, here I am. And we stand in that place like Jesus, who perfectly remained open to God and perfectly remained open to us. That's our call as believers, and that's the legacy of faith we've been given from Abraham. Let's pray. Father, sometimes we read things in your word that are difficult for us to handle. And so often we read those stories and we read them like today. And so, Father, help us to see beyond those things. Help us to not just have those knee-jerk reactions, but to really pay attention to what's going on and to what you're doing. And then, Father, more than anything, we just want to be open to you as you call us. We want to be able to say, we want to have the faith like Abraham to say, here I am to you. And then to other people to be able to say the same thing, here I am. That's how we look more like Jesus every day. We remain open to you no matter what you call us or ask us to do. And we remain open to others, even when it might be a sacrifice, it might be a pain, it might be a struggle. That's the faith that we're handed from Abraham. Father, you gave your son, and unlike Abraham and Isaac, you allowed it to go through. You allowed your son to die on that hill in our place. And over all other things, God, we thank you. We thank you for being willing to make a sacrifice that you didn't make Abraham go through with. And we thank your son, like Isaac, for being willing to walk up that hill and die in our place. Thank you, Father, in Jesus' name.